Neve Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neve's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit nevesolicitors.co.uk. Neve Solicitors, your complete legal solution.
Welcome to the show today. We are discussing what could be considered quite a taboo subject, but we want to kind of focus in on why parents need to help their children talk honestly about their bodies. So we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, what do we name the parts of the body? What do you say to your child when they want to tell you, a little boy wants to tell you about his willy, his penis? What do you say? And we're going to look into how that can actually have an impact on helping our children to keep themselves safe. We've got some great guests lined up for you tonight. We've got Marilyn Halls, who is the founder and the director of Enough Abuse. And her work is very much about breaking the cycle and changing children's lives. And then we've got Catherine Nibbs, who's going to talk to us on the phone. Catherine is a child therapist specialising in trauma and abuse, and a CEO of a company called Peer Support. So a packed show, and don't forget, you can get in contact with us in various ways, whether you want to come and talk to us on Facebook at Radio Verulam's Parent Show, or you can follow us on Twitter at Twitter at Parent Show.
That's right. Now, first up, we're talking to Marilyn Hawes, who is hopefully joining us on the line at the moment. Marilyn, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thanks a million for joining us on the Parents Show. So, Marilyn, you're the founder and you're the director of an organisation called Enough Abuse.
Yeah, Enough Abuse UK.
Can you tell us a little bit about the organisation and how it came about?
It came about from the back of my own experience 12 years ago when I discovered my own three sons had been abused by their head teacher. I was very ill for 2 years. I felt suicidal. I had a nervous breakdown. I'd been a teacher. I'd no idea how this had got past me because I taught in the same school and the abuser was the head teacher. And whilst I was busy having my nervous breakdown, I decided to research as to why. Why would somebody do this? What are the issues? What do they have going on in their childhood? Or why do you and how do you become an offender? So I started looking into all of that. Just a massive believer in education. Yes, I felt angry. Yes, I wanted to kill him. But that wouldn't have achieved anything. It would put me in jail. So after a couple of years and still waiting to see therapists and all the rest of it, I'd done all this research. I put together, I wrote a book about how it felt to be the mother in this situation because there was no help out there. And I didn't feel there was enough help on the education for parents and teachers and staff, which is still the case. I've just come back from Kent today, having done three training sessions with experienced trained adults and childcare practitioners, and the results of the training that I do flagged up an average of 70% as being new and relevant to them that they don't get taught on the established courses. And that's what I did with the information I learnt. I put it together into, with my teacher experience, it wasn't difficult for me to put together a workshop because it's just like a massive lesson plan. And it's just grown organically from there, and I do a lot on the media. And the charity itself, it raises money to, because all the cutbacks, it was for a while, it was not for profit. And then I thought, well, let's have a charity here with all the cutbacks. For example, in the Midlands, a third of the children's centres have been closed down with the cutbacks, and the other two-thirds have all their funding cut, so they can't have training, and that is disgraceful. That's not child protection. That's abdication of responsibility. So there's that, and also, if you can catch people who have been abused when they're younger, in their teens, it's like holding on to something heavy. The longer you hold on for it, the more damage it does. And if you can get them younger, adults want to now get some therapy. Not everybody can afford it, and we raise money to pay for that therapy so people's lives can change and they can try and find a way back from the hell they're living in.
So, Marilyn, sorry, there's a lot of information to process there. And I'm so sorry that you... there's such a sad reason for you setting up the organisation. That must have been incredibly traumatic for you.
It was hell. You can't imagine. It's hell. And I've been massively involved with the media in regard to Adam Brooks and Miles Bradbury. He's been on the news again tonight. You know, the paediatrician that abused little baby, little tiny cancer patients.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I've always said there's only one thing worse. I mean, I've been divorced. I've had all sorts of stuff in my life that's been horrendous that other people haven't experienced. This was something in a complete stratosphere of its own. And for me, there was only one thing that could have been worse, and that was if my child had died. And to have the combination of the both, I don't know how those poor parents cope.
Yeah.
I don't know how they're coping. It is just the worst thing that can happen.
It's utterly,
the world you knew is gone forever.
Yeah, it's an utterly disgusting story.
It's devastating.
Isn't it?
And of course, you know, I was groomed. He'd been my best friend for 17 years. He was a churchgoer. He used to sit behind me in church. He was my best friend. He was my boss. Everybody loved him. I was so proud that we had this friendship. And, of course, that's the problem. The grooming is so nice. This is what I've been saying today. You know, what people don't realize is the adults that are the protective shield of the child are groomed before the child itself. Because if the child is young, you're not just going to have direct access to that child without an adult who cares for that child being in the way. So you will be groomed first. You enter into this grooming process to gain your trust, and you get suckered in, then the access, and they will wait. They will wait a long time.
And
we're
not talking about
rape here. We're talking about someone who is working their skills in a plausible, sound way as they see it. Exaggerated behavior gives you a quirky feeling, but you don't really know what it is. And so you carry on with the relationship because they're not going to let you go. They start controlling you. Controlling your mind, controlling your thoughts.
And how do you think predators like that identify their targets or their victims?
Because they will wait. They test. So if you're parents who are strongly, I like the fact that you get a lot of parents, young parents today, which, I mean, I'm a dinosaur, it never happened in my day, but I look at my own son and his friends and the joint parenting of togetherness, you know, we are a unit, is powerful. And, you know, you're respecting each other as parents, you're working at it together as a team. Where there's flakiness, when there is an issue, maybe, and the abuser, the offender will smell it on you. If there's a vulnerability, if there's a fragility in your relationship, you don't even have to have a fragility in your relationship per se. It could be that one of you has to go away a lot with your job. You needn't necessarily be low-income family, a single parent. All families are at risk, and all children are at risk. This is a classless, cultureless, creedless crime, and it's global. And I'm even going to step out further than that and say it is so rife, and I can say this with every confidence in my heart, that we all know a child being abused. One in five children in the UK are reporting serious abuse. They are in every school.
That's an astounding figure, Marilyn.
It gets worse. One in five adults report having been abused, right, as a child.
As a child.
What's more scary is 88% of children on adults won't tell. So it's worse. We all know a child abused being abused. We all know an adult who has been. You will be working with them. Do the maths. And we all know someone who's doing it.
Yeah.
And they don't walk around with a beacon on their head. It's in every street in the country. Child sexual exploitation is in every town across the UK. Not just Rotherham and Rochdale. It's everywhere.
So,
and when children stand on street corners and are hanging around on their own, nothing ever good happened to them.
Marilyn, can you help our parents?
Can you?
There are parents that are listening. Can you give them some kind of, tips? Not strong enough a word, but how can they be talking to their children so they don't scare them, but they give them, you know, the confidence and the language they need?
There's lots of things. I think I actually sent you a flyer, and I can send it again. We've done a lot of research on literature for parents because I think that is a very valid point, and I get asked it a lot. When do I start talking about it? How would I introduce it? And, you know, I have to say, I know on the brief that you sent me, one of the things you said was, I think I've got it here, where it says about children, how would I say something to my 13-year-old son about sex-related matters? Well, I think your 13-year-old son probably knows more than you may do,
right,
because they're very out there about the mechanics of it. But it's about respecting yourself, taking care of yourself. You know, yeah, my body belongs to me. But it's also this quirky feeling. It's so difficult. It's the over-exaggeration of attention, the over-exaggeration of affection and trying to get this child isolated, the over-exaggeration of treats. You see, the trouble is with grooming, we all like it. You know, you name me an adult that doesn't like being loved, hugged, given presents, made to feel special, and have surprises. That's grooming. But it's in its exaggeration of that where you think, that's odd. I thought, quirky little feelings, you write them down. I have an acronym called SAFER. What is it Enough Abuse does? SAFER. You sense it. In your gut, you sense it. You become alert to it. Don't engage your brain and try and dumb yourself down saying, it can't be, it's a teacher. It can't be, it's a priest. It can't be, it's a swimming instructor. Don't engage your brain. Go with your gut. Focus on it. Engage with it. And write it down. Just record it. Is this a one-off? Have I seen this before? Is this happening to another family? And if you really do feel this gut quirky feeling, put distance, see what happens, withdraw from the relationship and your child, hold back and watch and see what happens. Where else will that person go? Because I kid you not, they will find someone else. There will be a rolling program of people. If you don't respond, somebody else will.
And see, Marilyn,
if it's a nature thing, like if you have the cat and the bird, how does the bird know the cat's a predator? How does any animal know when their predators are around? They know by instinct. What do? They move away. They run. They put themselves in a safe place. What do? We say, uh-uh, funny feeling. Oh, look at this. Must be the priest. Must be nice. Must be my friend. It's my husband's best mate. It's my dad. It's my auntie. Can't possibly be. And we continue. And we ignore the behaviour of the child. The child's behaviour will be the clue. I always say to my son, do not make my little grandson kiss me goodbye. I don't want him to be rude to me, but allow children to make their own assessment. I don't have to have my grandson on my lap. I'm not needy in that way. So when I go, come and sit on my lap, come and sit on my lap, whose needs are being met? If a child wants to sit on your lap, they will. If a child wants a hug, they come and find you. Don't push your belief system onto a child like that, as long as the child isn't being rude. You know, this thing, oh, you must kiss granddad goodbye. You must kiss, but why?
Yeah, I think that's a whole other realm, Marilyn, and it's probably one that it's a bit more contentious because, you know, family should be able to be affectionate with one another without having to worry about the danger of that.
Well, the trouble is, my dear, that 60% of children who are sexually abused is by the family.
Yeah, yeah.
And 30% on top of that is by friends.
Absolutely. It's been incredibly, you know, eye-opening hearing the fact, you know, your facts, Marilyn, your experience. Just before we let you go, just let us know, is there any coming back from this? You know, can you heal a child?
If you get it younger, if the quicker you disclose, we've actually, because I do get very frustrated with the government systems, we've actually launched an online reporting system called Hear Me. We don't have mandatory reporting in this country for people who are childcare managers, and that needs to happen, but we're a long way from it. So you go on Hear Me, you can suss out and check out with child abuse lawyers, with people who really understand this subject, is this grooming? You know, I don't want to make a false allegation. Of course you don't. All that stuff is sorted out. Everything you say, do and send is in a secure workplace and goes to the right people that will help. You can do a selfie of yourself. A child can sit in the loo and talk into its mobile phone. It can use signage if the child is unfortunately deaf or dumb. It can use signage. You know, there's a way back if you get it young enough. You can thrive and not just survive. But this, whether people like it or not, you are still more likely to be sexually abused by somebody who is best friends of your parents than you still are by the internet, because we work with the Cyberstalking Research Centre in University of Bedfordshire and Luton, and they've done research on this. So however the horrors of the internet are, you are still more likely to be abused by someone that's come through your front door, trusted and loved by your parents.
Thank you, Marilyn. That
is shocking.
If you learn,
fine. Yeah. you'll recognise it because your gut will tell you.
Thank you, Marilyn, and thanks for your passion and your commitment.
No,
and
I
thanks
don't
for
want
all
any other mothers
doing.
To be like me. You don't want my life, I can tell you.
Well, I hope things improve greatly with all the work you're doing. Thanks a million, Marilyn.
Things that would improve greatly if people actually took their head out of the sand and did what Kent have done. Kent Safeguarding have now got our education packages working right across their safeguarding system, because reporting, the current safeguarding systems are inept. Reporting and recording and processing and procedures will not prevent abuse. That's just reporting what's already happened.
Yeah, it's after the fact. Marilyn Hawes, thank you so much
for
joining us
time.
In the Parents' Unit. All
thank
the best.
You.
Welcome back to the Parents Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. So we've heard from Marilyn Hawes from the personal experience of a parent and her the impact on her of sexual abuse of her children or her child. Now we'd like to move on and talk to Catherine Nibbs, who is on the phone to us now, and she deals more with the psychological fallout of sexual abuse. Catherine, are you there?
I am, yes. Can you hear me?
I can indeed. Thanks a million for joining us on the Parents Show this evening.
Not a problem.
So, Catherine, can you tell us a little bit? You're a therapist and you specialise in trauma and abuse of,
yeah.
of children. Tell us what your online, offline theory is.
Okay. So, children at the moment are in a slightly different world to most adults. I used to, and basically the way that children are now experiencing the world is through technology, and I've likened this in an interview I did not so long ago to the way we use toasters. Okay, so quite often people will refer to children as digital natives, where I don't see that's how us as adults actually use toasters as being a toaster native. We just use tools that are there. So what's happening with children nowadays is they have like a permanent connection to lots and lots of different people via lots and lots of different mediums. And what I've been looking at and researching is the way that children are constantly connected. So you might see this with technology such as smartphones, iPads, computers, gaming consoles and so on. And the way that these children are connected to the internet permanently is these accessories are accessible by other people at any time, and the children can access cyberspace at any time as well. So for adults, we have the conception and probably the very deep understanding that to connect to the internet, you have to go to your computer, you have to turn it on, and then you effectively dial up, or as it used to be, dial up. That isn't the case for children nowadays. So the phones that they carry around with them are, you know, permanently connected to the internet, which means, in essence, they are permanently on, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So mm-hmm. there's access to a whole world that we don't really understand or know at any time.
I think that many adults have an inkling as to what cyberspace is, but actually don't fully understand it. And even though I'm working in this area and I am researching it, I probably don't understand as much as the young people and young adults do today.
And tell us, is there a point in a child's brain when they do or they don't understand sexual abuse?
I would actually say that viscerally all children understand that something doesn't feel okay. So a child would know that something doesn't feel okay. So before the ages of about 2, it would be classed as pre-verbal. So you'd be looking at a very, very immature brain who would experience feelings that weren't okay. And the way that children tend to behave in this manner is very similar to what Marilyn was saying earlier about the fight or flight area, okay? In the brain, there is an area called the amygdala. And this is a tiny almond-shaped area which is responsible for fear, and it regulates stress. So what would happen with a child is the amygdala would say, okay, this is not a good situation to be in, this doesn't feel okay, and the behaviour that the child would exhibit would be something like freezing. So where Marilyn said a bird might know that a cat is a predator, it would actually instinctively try and move away from the cat. Children, obviously, under the age of two are very incapable of doing this, so they would exhibit a different response, which would be to freeze. Children who are slightly older, so above two, may well know that something's wrong and be able to use very, very simplistic language, but would have difficulty in explaining this to another person. So the way that young children regulate their emotions is through behaviour, and they may well act out or act in. So they may become naughty, they may have more temper tantrums, they may show regressive behaviour and start behaving very much like a young child again, or perhaps not do anything and become very, very withdrawn and quiet and not use other parts of their brain. So the kind of neuroscience that we're learning about at the moment shows that when the amygdala sets off this stress response, that it actually stops certain parts of the brain's working as efficiently as they could do in normal circumstances, and that exhibits itself in behaviour.
Catherine, when you know, you talked about this online sort of environment that our children are living in.
Yeah.
Now, how do you think that's affecting their communication about, you know, their bodies and sort of sexual behaviour and that kind of thing? Because they're obviously seeing images, aren't they, that, you know, I guess as a woman in my 40s, I just didn't have access to.
Okay, so I'll start with the first part of the question, which is the communication. Okay, younger people, I'm sure we all know, talk in a language that we probably don't understand as adults. Okay, so I'm really, really interested in a lot of the words that they use and how, for example, the word sick has actually become to mean something that can either be really, really good or really, really bad, and also mean exactly the definition that appears in the dictionary. So when children are communicating nowadays, it's done in very much text speak. So they shorten words, they change words, and there's a lot of, I would say, hip-hop language that's come over the years, and the way that language is communicated between people nowadays is no different to when you or I were younger. You know, we had our own words. They were probably very outdated now.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's happening in this cyberspace is because of certain types of music and certain types of videos and images that are being shared, there is quite an element of misogynistic and sexist language that's being used. And children are starting to communicate in this way without fully understanding what those words mean. And the second part of the question was what they're actually watching. This is actually something I really, really am interested in, is, you know, what happens to a child's brain, what happens to their communication, what happens to basically their ability to be empathic with other people as well when they are watching these videos that are on a scale of 1 to 100, I don't know, because I don't know what every child is watching. And I know that the UK Safer Internet place, the UK Safer Internet and Internet Watch Foundation and CEOP and all of the online research establishments are trying to take a look at this, but it's very, very difficult to do because there is an element of children not wanting to basically admit to what they've been doing. And when they do get asked, they are generally very honest, but it's trying to tap into those children and say, okay, who's been watching this, without that becoming a shaming experience for them.
So, I mean, just looking at it really simply, you know, parents who have got young children that are listening tonight, can you say to them, you know, how could they be talking to their children about their bodies?
Okay. So I think we did have a quick chat about this yesterday, that actually the language that we are really, I would advise using with children, very much comes from the PHSE education that's currently being pushed towards Parliament at the moment. That realistically, we need to be using anatomical, biological, correct terminology with children. Now, I understand that parents can be very embarrassed by correct terminology. But when you start to use different names for body parts in your family, there is the possibility that that word may not be used by any other family. It's probably likely, but yeah. there is a chance, which would leave a child with a language skill that they wouldn't be able to communicate with other people. And children don't tend to get embarrassed by the word penis. They know that it reflects a certain part of their anatomy, and if children can become comfortable with saying, well, this is my, and giving an anatomical term, mm. that parents can then communicate in the same way that the child is doing, and everybody knows what everybody else is talking about.
Catherine, could I just ask you a question? Because I mean, personally, as a parent, I'm not keen on that recommendation. Obviously, you know,
yeah.
if that's what experts like yourself say, you know, that's the path I've got to go. But kids often don't even need to use the word. They can kind of get the sentiment across by just pointing and stuff. And if somebody is interfering with your child, does it matter that they don't know the anatomical word for what it is? You know, and they know a kind of an infant-like word that you've taught them.
Yeah, that's... Okay. The communication that a child would actually have in order to tell you what was happening tends to be caught up in the psychological effects, okay? So a child who has been abused will have been manipulated in some way to feel ashamed about what has happened.
Yeah.
And that shame is actually the precursor that prevents them communicating with you.
Right.
So one of the things that I'm suggesting is if people are communicating in a shame-free way by saying, like the NSPCC have suggested the pants rule, that these are your privates, yeah. and that would be an acceptable way to talk to very young children, that they would be able to say, a person touched my privates, a person did this, and they would have to have the ability to overcome the shameful feelings at that point in time to communicate with you what had happened. And that's where it gets very, very difficult for young children, is the feeling of shame actually causes the same response from the amygdala that the incident does itself, and also the after effects of the psychological grooming.
Right.
So you are a bad person because you allowed this to happen. Is often the way that a child feels, and through therapy, this is really what we're starting to see is that children are saying, "I am a bad person. This is my fault," because they have been told that.
It's just such a horrendous concept to think that we even have to deal with our children, and that it is so commonplace is even more scary. But
yeah.
And Catherine, when you're talking about using, so say we use the correct anatomical words, at what point, I mean, do you just use the correct anatomical words from the word go, you know, even with 2-3-year-olds?
To be honest, as a parent myself, it can be very difficult. You know, they are very long words to actually pronounce for a very young child as well anyway. But it is a personal matter, and I understand this is why we're having a difficulty in this day and age of communicating with our children. It would be a really lovely world if we could say, right, this is what we call everything and this is how we go forward. But, you know, families have their own traditions, family have their own ways of saying things, and sometimes it's a very, very taboo subject, and parents who haven't had that kind of education struggle to work in that way. So my recommendation would be, yes, in a harmonious, lovely, and nothing ever happened that was bad world, we could all communicate in this way, and we could all do it from very, very early on. But it doesn't always work that way with families.
Yeah.
But what I think is really important, and it's something that I'm picking up on a lot with children, is they feel scared to tell an adult. So if it's a family member, they would feel scared to tell another adult. And if it was another adult, they would feel terrified or shamed in order to tell their parents. And that's to do with the fear of the response of telling another person. And it's all mixed up for young children, and this is where they get very, very mixed up, muddled, and it makes it very difficult to communicate this.
We can really hear how, you know, it makes sense what you're saying. So, I mean, just putting it really simply, are you encouraging parents of young children to just be matter of fact, you know, and use the anatomical terms as Lydia said, you know, from two or whenever, and try not to engender that feeling of, you know, embarrassment or shame. Would that be a really good piece of advice for our listeners?
Yeah, and one thing that I would suggest is there are some absolutely fabulous resources. Again, right. One of the things that I will say is, as much as the internet has the dark side, which we've kind of touched upon, there are some fabulous websites, fabulous resources, and the Sex Education Forum, they have some really good kind of resources that you can get to. And one of the other things that I wanted to say is for children who are about 13, 14 years of age, so I think you spoke with Marilyn about this kind of language, there is a website called bishuk.com. It's an award-winning website. The gentleman who runs it has put a lot of time and effort into putting language out there that children can relate to, but there are also parent resources.
Okay, that's so fantastic.
That would be a really good resource for parents to go to first to say, okay, how do I approach this subject? And for young children to be able to look at the website and look up, how do I ask this question? Mm. Is this an okay thing to ask an adult? You know, sex can be very embarrassing, so sexual abuse is more so.
Right,
absolutely.
And that's really how children... This, at the moment, we in this country tend to treat sex and anything to do with sex in a very taboo and embarrassed and stiff upper lip manner.
So you said Bish...
Bish, B-I-S-H...
.co.uk. Great stuff. We'll drop...
.com. It's bishuk.com.
bishuk.com. We'll pop that up on our Facebook page straight away. So that's a great one. So that kind of tells you how to talk to your children not in a self-conscious way, not in a way that gives them any kind of feeling of insecurity about their private parts or anything. It just kind of helps you. And does it give you guidance on how to talk to your children about, like...
I think that's... It's got some resources on there, yes. But one of the things that I would say is it is also a natural part of a child's progression through childhood to have certain phases where they become embarrassed about their body. So they will want privacy. And actually, that's another thing that is really, really important in a household is being respectful of a child's right to a privacy. And I think Marilyn was talking earlier about... how some children are to quote in inverted commas, forced to go and give grandma a kiss goodbye. And actually, for children who are sexually abused, they don't have the autonomy to say no and give themselves a boundary. So being respectful of a child's right to privacy is also a really important part about the communication that goes between child and parent, is parents saying, okay, I expect privacy from you, and I also respect that you also need that.
So if your child suddenly starts to say, you know, go out of my room, you can't see me anymore, or I don't want anybody coming into the shower, is it a sign of anything happening, or is it just a natural stage?
Yeah, that's a $50 million question.
Oh, is it? Okay.
It is a normal part of behaviour, and what would be my advice would be to say, okay, I hear that you feel embarrassed, and I'm going to leave you to have that privacy, but if you feel that there's something you need to talk to me about, being a parent who can say, I am here and I am ready to hear what you need to tell me whenever you need to tell me, and we will deal with whatever you tell me, rather than what happens with most parents, and again it's the amygdala kicking in when a child says, I think that XYZ is happening, for the parent to go and for their fear response to suddenly kick in, and it becomes that moment where the child goes, oh no, and then the instinctive feeling of, I feel ashamed, I am bad, I have caused that reaction. And that's one of the things that children explicitly tell me in therapy is, I couldn't tell anybody because it would have hurt them, it would have upset them, they would have been scared, and to quote quite a lot of children, they would have flipped their lid, is what they usually say.
That's so sad, isn't it, to hear. I was listening to an interview the other day, actually, and it was a famous race jockey who said it took him 2 years to share the information with somebody, you know, that was in his sphere of mentors, really. And I just thought, that's such a long time, Catherine, isn't it? 2 years for him to eventually be able to feel he could tell what happened to him.
I think, but knowing what I know about the way that people react with trauma, that's actually not a long time.
Is it not?
On average, you are looking at maybe 13, I think it's between 13 and forever,
really?
Amount of years for somebody to actually come forward. Even veterans with PTSD take 13 years.
Gosh, okay.
So
right.
Trauma has a really, really long-lasting visceral effect, and it's all embedded in shame and the not knowing that this is normal to feel like this. So that's one of the education areas that I'm looking at, hopefully bringing to light, is saying to people, you know, look, shame is a really, really powerful emotion, and it prevents people dealing with their feelings of trauma and abuse in a way that makes it very difficult. So 2 years, I think that's a really, really good turnaround time for that person.
Compared to the average figure. Shows how little I know about it. What about this? One of the parents had shared with me that she felt shame, actually, and she was so cross with herself that she'd let her 9-year-old daughter go and stay with a friend. The friend and the dad and the daughter had all slept together in a tent, but the little girl who lived in the house, she was taken out in the night because she was scared. So this woman's daughter was left all night in the tent, a 9-year-old, with the dad of, you know, her friend. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and the mother had said to me, she just felt sick, you know. I mean, would you have any response to that?
Yes, there's two responses. I can give you a professional response and I can also give you a parent response. Okay, so my professional response would be, in that circumstance, the mum is now unaware of what's happened. Okay, so questions would arise about, did anything happen? What do I need to do? How do I approach it? As a mum, I totally understand the fear that would come from that. Oh my goodness, a child was left with an adult. I am sat with, and it's a very kind of bipolar answer here, that part of me says perhaps nothing happened whatsoever and it was a completely safe situation and the media has had such an impact on in the last 10 years that people now suspect that any adult may well have done something, okay? Compared to the other side, which says, okay, if something did happen, how do I approach this?
Yeah.
And it's very, very important that if you are going to ask questions of a child that, as I've said, really making yourself open to, I'm wondering what it was like for you to spend the night out in that tent. It sounds like it might have been a bit scary.
Yeah.
So that you're actually making a tentative inquiry without, leading the question, did somebody touch you?
Okay.
Because children might fear that they have to please their parent and give the response, yes. In which case you're then down the road of possibly a false allegation. But if you say to a child, I would have been very scared if I was in the tent on my own, and then I might have been even more scared when so-and-so, but actually the child might say, well, actually, the daughter's dad just said to me, don't worry, I'll sit up, and he stayed awake and, you know, kept an eye on me, and then he fell asleep, or I stayed awake and kept an eye on him, or you might just get a bit of a fairy tale about what happened, and it might turn out to be all okay. But if something has happened, making a tentative inquiry and saying that you wondered how it felt, but then being in a position to say, and if you needed to tell me something happened and you weren't very comfortable with it, I'm here to listen to what you need to tell me. And one of the things that I would suggest, and this is really how it works in therapy, but how it works with the police as well, is that leading questions are not asked.
Okay.
So it would be, could you tell me more about that? What happened then? Can you describe? Rather than why, what, who, and all the questions that actually cause the fear response, the shame response.
Yeah.
And, you know, children do like to please people. So if they think that giving you an answer will please you, then they will do so without understanding the consequences of what may then happen. So it's very, very important that if you do speak to a child, that you're looking for facts. You're not looking for reasoning and you're not looking for judgment. And that's very, very difficult to do as a parent.
Yeah.
It
Catherine,
is very difficult.
Yeah, you know, thank you. That is, you've explained it so clearly and so calmly. So thank you so much for your expertise. And I'm sure that, you know, you've allayed maybe some fears for some parents listening in, but just given us some strategies and... you know, particularly on the language side of it. So thank you so much, and we'll put up your information on our website.
Okay, lovely.
Okay.
It's been lovely speaking to you.
Yeah, thanks so much for your time.
Okay.
All right,
thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Neave Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neave's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit nevesolicitors.co.uk. Neve Solicitors, your complete legal solution.